amount of stored thermal energy in that material when you move it from 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. The thermometer tells you what's going on, but if you had, let me drop, if you had the world's most ideal telescope, microscope, what you would see happening is that you think the thermometer is measuring temperature, and it is measuring something you call temperature, but what is temperature? Average kinetic energy of those molecules, the individual molecules of that water, are moving it around at a certain average speed at 40 degrees Fahrenheit. In order for you to get them at 60 degrees Fahrenheit, every darn one of those molecules in that container must be moving at a faster speed. You have to put extra energy in there to do that.
Yeah, but the thing is that the higher the energy level, the faster the cars go, the less energy is needed to move it to next speed and to exit.
You said that, but I don't agree. If I measured the number of calories required to move a gram of water from 40 degrees centigrade to 60 degrees centigrade, 1 gram of water, 40 degrees centigrade to 60 degrees centigrade, it's going to take exactly 20 calories to do that. To go from 60 degrees centigrade to 80 degrees centigrade, it's going to take something very close to 20 calories again to do that. Now, water has got a peculiar characteristic. It expands a little bit as a function of temperature, so you've got to make sure that you're talking about the same number of grams of water, not necessarily cubic centimeters of water, because it's about to change its volume as a function of temperature. If I've got the exact same number of grams of water, which means I've got the same number of molecules of water, except for a couple of very minor nonlinearity characteristics, to go from 20 centigrade to 40 centigrade, and to go from 40 centigrade to 60 centigrade, each one of those 20 degree temperature changes is going to require very close to 20 calories to do it.
Would you agree with the statement that the higher energy levels, the less energy is needed to sustain that level?
Negative. If the surrounding air is 0 degrees centigrade, and I've got water that started off at 20, and I'm raising it to 40, and I'm now going to sustain it at 40. The 40 degree centigrade water has got a certain amount of insulation to that 0 degree environment, and convective energy is coming off, radiation energy is off, and conductive energy. In other words, I've got it sitting on a stand, there's a certain amount of insulation between that pot of water and the stand, that's conduction. There's a certain amount of radiation taking place between that container and the environment, and the air coming off that container is creating convection. The greater the temperature difference between the object that you're studying, this container of water, and the surrounding environment, the greater that temperature difference, the greater are all three of those losses. So if I want to take a 0 degree environment in the wintertime and maintain that pot of water at 60 degrees centigrade instead of 40 degrees centigrade, it takes more energy to do that because the losses are greater.
Dick, you're contradicting yourself. You just said, if you have a high velocity of the swing, the less energy is used to maintain that particular stage than keep it in the swing of 5 centimeters or 5 inches.
Maybe I said it backwards, or maybe I'm being misquoted. If I was swinging the child at 1 foot back and forth, I had to continue to supply a certain amount of energy to overcome those losses. If I decide to swing this child higher, it takes more energy to get her to go from 1 foot of swinging to 2 feet of swinging, but once she's up to 2 feet of swinging and I maintain it, whatever losses were is now greater at two feet of swinging versus 1 foot of swinging. There are more losses at the greater amount of swing, and I must supply those losses.
Disagree. I've seen it hundreds of times in my burner. At the temperature, the higher the temperature, the less flame is on the burner. At a certain point, you see almost no flame at all.
Now, when you're talking about flame out of a Bunsen burner, a lot of other fancy dynamics are taking place. that flame does or doesn't wrap around the pot in a certain way, and the amount of coupled energy from the flame to the pot changes dramatically as a function of temperature of the pot, rate of the flame, velocity of the gas coming out of the burner. A lot of things are changing at the same time.
Yeah, you're trying to differentiate. The example is exactly the same everywhere. You have, and I can make a video and post it on YouTube and prove it to you. At a certain temperature, the flame is almost non-present. You see, you know, and then you say, okay, here is different environment, over there is not. I mean, I disagree with that, and to exist.
Let's do the experiment in a more pure way. I'm going to use a resistive heater in your pot of water. And with the resistive heater, I can measure the voltage across the resistor and the current through the resistor, and I can calculate exactly how many joules of heat I'm putting into that heater. And if I did it with a resistive heater in the pot of water, and if the environment in your house is 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and you raise the pot of water to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and you wanted to keep it at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, you have to put a certain amount of energy into that resistive heater. And now if you raise it 20 more degrees Fahrenheit and you want to maintain that temperature, the losses in your house will be greater. The total energy you put into that electric heater will be greater. You agree or disagree? Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
Disagree. You have to deliver more energy to get to the temperature. You spend less energy to keep the temperature. You have already room heated to the particular temperature. The room has a certain losses, say, minimum losses, and then you want to keep and maintain this temperature. The higher the temperature, the less the losses are. The higher the temperature, the less the flame is. And I said I can prove it. And you're going to see that. I've seen it. I especially took the cover from my heater, which is the very small unit hanging on the wall. Actually, it was a Junkers system invented by German during the Second World War and was purchased by Canadian, where they have a very cold temperature. And they found this 55% more efficient than typical oil or gas burner, N2XGN.
Almost everything I've heard and been taught about thermodynamics tells me the rate of heat loss is a function of the temperature difference. And I'm going to give you another example. I want to keep my house at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. On a medium winter day, it's 40 degrees Fahrenheit outside. There's a 30 degree delta in temperature. I am burning oil at a particular rate. If now the outside temperature goes to a lower temperature, it used to be 40, it now goes down to 20, there's a greater temperature difference between outside and the inside of my house. I say with that greater temperature difference, I will burn oil faster.
I agree with this, but you're taking the wrong equation. You're taking a temperature changes outside. I'm giving you the example of temperature being exactly the same. You just increase the temperature inside, and to exterior.
All of the laws on thermal loss through an insulating material are a function of the R factor of the material and the two temperatures. If the delta temperature is greater on the exact same material, the heat loss will be greater. You agree or disagree? Okay, I didn't hear that, Wes. Try it again.
I do agree.
Then what's different than what you're saying?
Well, the difference between what I say is that you have a certain environment that is a steady environment. You put an energy to that environment. Now, you need to deliver extra energy to change the temperature within that environment. Yes, you lose the energy. But then you find out that keep that energy level just in that particular stage or level takes less energy, then keep that temperature at the stage of, let's say, zero to any other lower stage. The higher it goes, the less energy you need to overgo it and to exchange.
Okay. Okay, you're giving me two separate answers that are conflicting. One answer was, you told me the rate of thermal energy loss for a given material of a known R factor is a function of the temperature difference. With a greater temperature difference, the rate of heat loss is greater. You agreed to that. Now if I take your pot of water and heat it to a higher temperature...
you're taking your consideration pot of water. Don't take the pot of water. You have a pipe and you have a water flowing through that pipe. It's a very thin pipe. Let's say 1/4 of an inch or one or even smaller. And you have a water flowing at very low rate through that pipe. Now you put a flame in order to heat it up. The flame goes up. It heats that, let's say, 1 second. Let's say 10 seconds. That's fine. Let me drop. Then you all of a sudden see that electronics in that furnace is taking the flame out and then modulating the same way as you do with the swing. At the right time, at the right frequency, according to the water flow. Then, what it's doing is modulating at the same frequency, but the flame is getting smaller, 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 till the point where the flame is almost invisible, but is still fluctuating. Did you get the picture? And so it's
here. KC2QIQ with a clarification.
There's a whole lot of things that are not described here. It's a thin pipe with water flowing through it. You didn't tell me where the water is coming from. You didn't tell me where the water is going to. You didn't tell me the starting temperature of the water. You didn't tell me the ending temperature of the water.
Okay, I'm going to tell you. The water is coming from the cold water. The cold water is coming within the closed system of the heating system of your house. Now, the more you heat the water, the less energy you need to maintain that energy level. I mean, no, I didn't say it properly. Now you're going to catch me on the word. The temperature of the water overall is hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And then you see that your flame is still modulating. Now, the flame is modulating according to the speed of the pump that is pushing the water. At a certain point, you see that the flame is almost non-present. But if you look carefully, you see modulation happening again and to exist.
Okay. I'm beginning to think you've got a hot water-fired heating system in your house, and I'm guessing a gas flame is heating that water. Is that true?
Well, it's a heating system, crew heaters, units in the walls, and then you have something that is a very unique structure. It is Junkers, German technology from the Second World War, purchased by Canadian and known right now by the name Luna. Luna 310 FI. Now, this is one of the first ones. Didn't have efficiency of 45%. It did have efficiency of 55% comparing to any regular burner heating system in the house. And that is happening. Can make a video, no problem, and to HGM.
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
It sounds like you're telling us you've got hot water, baseboard, radiation, heating in your house, and it's fired by some kind of a gas-fired furnace, is what it sounds like. And you're saying that when the water in your baseboard radiation gets hotter and hotter, less flame temperature is required, less flame volume is required to do that. And even if that's true, when the boiler is running at a higher temperature, the method by which the literally aerodynamics of flame takes place, the flame behaves very differently when it is heating a surface of a boiler at a different temperature.
I agree with that. You're completely right, 100%. You're just forgetting the fact that the room temperature is changing. There is a less to the desired level till you reach it. And then when you maintain it, there is a less energy needed just to maintain it.
Okay, I'm going to agree with that one. Whenever I've had my heat go off in the house, for a period of time, and then I turn the furnace on, and I watch the temperature rise versus time. It rises very slowly, for a very good reason. My house has a lot of specific heat. I've got chunks of steel, I've got chunks of furniture, I've got chunks of wood, I've got all kinds of stuff in the house. You're not just heating the air of the house. The air is what you sense, but you're heating all of those other objects in the house. So as you ask for a temperature change, it's very similar to what happens with that pot of water. A lot of energy is required to make a change of all of that mass. You're not just changing the air in my house. Maybe is a total of 100 pounds of air, but I've got 5,000 pounds of other stuff in the house, and I've got to heat all of that 5,000 pounds, not just 100 pounds of air. And that's a very slow heating process, because the coupling coefficient between the radiator, the air, and all that other stuff, there's a whole bunch of series thermal resistances, and I've got to work through all of those thermal resistances before the 5,000 pounds of stuff in my house finally gets warm when it's been cold for the last 2 days. Glenn, I know you want to make a comment on this. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I think one of the things that Wesley is seeing here, too, with the flame tips, are that the flame tip for different temperatures, like a typical tip for like welding or tips and burners, are actually designed to operate within a certain range of temperature. And a lot of that has to do with the length of the tip itself and the opening of the orifice at the end and exactly how much velocity of gas goes through it. So it's going to have an efficiency at a temperature where if you were to try to have a higher efficiency, let's say a jet or a nozzle that's feeding a flame at a lower temperature, it's going to want, you'd actually want a little bit wider diaphragm and, orifice opening and basically a lower pressure to give you more efficient at a lower temperature. So depending on the temperature efficiency of the tip itself, might also add to that effect. So that, like Wesley's saying, when it finally gets to that temperature, you know, if you try to run it at the higher temperature, it looks like it's actually operating more efficiently, probably because the tip is probably designed for a very specific temperature range, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Additional comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, it sounds a little insane to me because whether it be a ship's boiler or my hot water heater at home, if there's no consumption, I keep it at 140 degrees, it costs so much fuel. If I raise it to 160 degrees without consumption, it costs me more fuel to maintain that temperature. So I don't know where that's going.
Yes, it costs you because you deliver the extra energy to heat to the desired temperature. But if you were to keep that house at that temperature and then compare for 2 days, and then compare the amount of energy that is used to heat that house at the lower temperature, you would see that the difference might be that you use less temperature at the higher temperature of the house, assuming that you have a good insulation. Now, there is a catch in here. The catch in here, difference of the temperature. When you have outside a temperature of the same, and you try to heat the house more, then the difference between the losses of the energy going outside may cause more usage of the gas. But if you have a good insulation, the higher the temperature, the easier is to hold that temperature and less energy is being used. And to Adrian.
No way.
I'm going to challenge that one, Wesley. Let's assume now that for the next week, the outside temperature is going to stay 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And for this particular 2 days, you decide to hold the house at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and you measure the amount of gas that you burn holding the house at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Outside temperature is 40. And you're not going to change the insulation. You're not going to change how much you open the windows. And your wife, let's assume she comes from Florida and she likes hot weather, and she decides that let's keep the house at 80 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 70. And so for the next couple of days, you heat the house to 80 degrees Fahrenheit and keep it there. Are you telling me that at 80 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to burn less gas than you did at a steady temperature of 70 degrees Fahrenheit? Over to you, Wes.
Not necessarily. What you're going to have a problem with is the energy exchange. You have the same installation, you didn't do any changes. And then the difference between the temperature inside and temperature outside is bigger. Now, you're losing more energy because of that energy exchange. But if we assume, a situation in which we have a very good insulation, extremely good insulation, a good window, then keep the temperature higher or keep the car going faster is requires less energy to push to maintain the same speed and to exist.
Please don't agree.
Okay, I'm going to give you your ideal insulation in your house. I'm going to let you put R45 in every one of the walls. I'm going to give you triple thermal pane in every one of your windows. And the outside temperature for the next month is going to be 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And for the first week, you keep the house at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And then for the second week, you keep the house at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. You're telling me you're going to burn less gas at 80. I say you're going to burn more gas at 80. Over to you, Wes.
So, explain to me why then, when you have a heavy car like John has and I have, it is a need from the beginning for five guys, and then I was pushing quite a few times during this 13 years of having this car. That car by myself, and I was not really pushing a lot. It was a perfectly flat road, and I was able to keep it at the same speed, and I didn't feel as tired as if there was a red light and I had to push it again.
Further explanation, Dick?
Yeah, I think Glenn explained that as this peculiar characteristic of a rubber tire.
And what is peculiar characteristic of the rubber tire comes from?
The rubber tire, when it rolls very slowly, takes a set on each individual revolution. The rubber bends at the bottom and takes a set, and as it takes that set, when you're rolling very slowly, you are basically pushing uphill continuously. When you roll fast enough, the rubber doesn't get a chance to take that set, and the rubber tire itself becomes more efficient. It's a peculiar characteristic of the elastomer called rubber. That's what I think is going on. I think John's going to give us some words on this. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And a couple more words from me too, Dick. KC2QIQ.
And WS2N.
Okay. John, Glenn, and S2N in that order. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, what I was trying to say before is forget all this thermal insulation and thermal panes and all that crap. My hot water system is like a thermos bottle. Without consumption, to raise the temperature from 140 degrees, it costs X amount of dollars. To raise and keep that temperature at 160 cost more. Very efficient insulation, which doesn't really make any difference what the insulation is. You raise that temperature, it's going to cost you more to maintain that heat. There's no way around it. That's it. Back to you, Dick.
I think there is a way around. I would like Glenn to explain what he sees as a difference in dish. There is a horizontal pipe, and there is another pipe with the holes in it. The gas goes through the holes, and you see 20 different small flames. Let me jump. Now, at first time when the spark comes into it, the flame jumps. All of the 10 flames, or 20 flames, over there, hit that pipe, that is horizontal pipe, with the water. The speed of the water is maintained by the pump. Now, the flame, after 1 second, disappears and shows up again almost at the same level. Then it starts to fluctuate, it tries to resonate with the speed of the water. And then you see that the moment at which the flame is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, and the temperature in the room is becoming higher and higher and higher. At a certain point, you see almost no flame, but it's still fluctuating. Now, the frequency of fluctuation changes. Maybe this is the secret of it. And to Adrian.
Yeah, I see the possibility of the temperature of the gas inside of the burner with the burner mechanism with all the little holes where the flame squirts out. I see that mechanism as a kind of an organ pipe, and as the gas runs at a different temperature later on, air changes density significantly as a function of temperature. Therefore, that organ pipe resonates at a different frequency. That's a guess on my part. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. You're right on the money with that, because if you look at the way that the burner is designed, it usually has an operating temperature. In other words, excluding the water, which is a separate system that gets coupled to the operating temperature of the burner, the burner itself has like a set temperature. So you actually set that, and that temperature has to be within a certain temperature band in order to get the real efficiency out of the burner itself, unless, of course, you have a different design. In which you could theoretically run the burner at a lower temperature, but it would have to be redesigned jets and everything inside to operate at the lower temperature to conduct into the water. Let me let it drop for a second because I want to add something about the tires. This effect problem when you're pushing a car and being harder to push at lower speeds is more of a problem with the width of the tire. I mean, I know myself, I have a Corvette that barely weighs 3,000 pounds, but it's got very wide tires on it. And to push that car initially at 1 or 2 miles an hour, it's a bear at 3,000 pounds. But then I can take my Jeep, which weighs like closer to 4,000, it's a heavier vehicle, but it's got thinner, taller tires, and to initially push it, that's easier to push initially. So a lot of it really, that initial friction at low speed, a lot of it really has to do with the tire characteristics, Dick. And some of it can be really overcome by just hyperinflating the tire for very, very low speeds. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I got one hell of a question for you, Glenn. Your wide Corvette tires, you run them at how many pounds per square inch? Your narrow Jeep tires, you run them at how many pounds per square inch? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, the wider, lower profile tire runs, I think, at about 26 pounds, and the Jeep's tires that are taller and thinner run it close to 30 pounds, or 30, yeah, I think it's 30 pounds thick.
And you know that the fat wheel American bicycle tires, you ran them at something like 28 pounds per square inch. The very skinny English racer bicycle tires, you run them at 70 pounds per square inch. And you get a huge difference in efficiency partially. And also, in both cases, it's the right pressure. If you took that 70 pound per square inch skinny English racer tire and you decided to run that at 28 pounds per square inch, you'd be riding the rims on the road. And there's a whole explanation for that. And I think it's called the Newton effect. In other words, the diameter of the cross section of the tire makes a huge difference as to what skin tension you get versus fluid pressure on the inside. And it's that phenomenon that really has to be understood if you want to understand why an aneurysm in a blood vessel is such a dangerous condition. Paul wanted to make a question or a comment. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
WS2N, yeah, I wanted to go back to the cause. Moving. Whoever made the statement about putting the cars into outer space was right. It sounded like Barry, I don't know. But you take these same 2,000-pound cars and put them into outer space and give them a push. Or you might have a rocket belt or something, but have these people pushing the car, and it now accelerates at 100 miles an hour. I mean, using this whole thing in outer space, you could actually show that kinetic energy really doesn't exist. It's relative. It exists for the people that pushed it. Because this thing is now floating between the stars, let's say between Pluto and the next, Alpha Centauri. And you really have deep space, not much gravity around. And as this thing is floating, going from star system to another star system, the people that pushed it initially go away. And 1,000 years goes by, and here comes this other civilization from another planet, and they come across this thing, and they're looking at this 1955 Chevy floating through space. And as far as they're concerned, they have no idea where it came from or which direction it's going. As far as they're concerned, that thing has no kinetic energy. They come onto it, and as far as they're concerned, it's not even moving. And those other people are long gone, Dick. So, that's really the way to compare it. Now, if those people give it a push, fine. They now have kinetic energy as far as they're concerned. They might push in the opposite direction altogether. WS2N, back to you there, Dick.
Yeah, I think one thing that I see as a contradiction in your words, as far as you were describing that capacitor, you said at the right frequency, at the right time, you have a very little energy needed. Then I stated that when you have a higher push, let me jump. When I have a higher push, at the end of the swing, I just tip that swing, and there is a very little energy that is needed for the swing to go back, and you lose very little energy. Then you said, no. When we have a higher swing, we use more energy. I mean, I don't understand your statements, and to actually.
When the child is swinging at a greater deflection, the total amount of velocity due to wind resistance is greater. That's one of the loss mechanisms. The total amount of centrifugal force when the child is at the bottom of the swinging motion puts a little bit more force on the bearing, and the bearing has a certain amount of loss. A greater amount of swing has a slightly greater continuous loss compared to a very small amount of swinging. There's another way you can see it, and that is you can set the child swinging, and now you make a graph of the deflections of the child versus time. You watch the child swing down, and you'll see the rate of decay of her swinging is greater in the beginning than it is at the end. It's an exponential decay. The rate that she's losing energy and swinging less and less, the rate of loss of energy will be slower at the end than it is in the beginning. There's a greater loss of energy in the beginning. Now, getting back to that 1955 Chevy moving through space. If these space people, let me drop, have got a real good galactic version of a global positioning satellite system, with reference to the fixed stars, with reference to our sun and Alpha Centauri, they can take accurate references and figure out the real velocity of the car. And let's assume now that in free space, I release the car at 100 miles an hour. 100 years later, if there's no other gravity effects and resistance effects and going through gas clouds or whatever, that car will be moving 100 miles an hour. And somewhere in the middle of that experiment, I decide to give a little bit of extra push, and now the car is moving 120 miles an hour in free space. A year later, the car will still be moving 120 miles an hour. Whatever speed I give it. Newton's first law says if you don't act on something, it keeps doing exactly what it's done. Is that Newton's either first or second law?
First law. Body put in motion, stay in motion.
Okay. So if Newton's first law is accurate in free space, it requires no energy at all to maintain that new velocity. The only thing that requires me to put in extra energy when I'm moving that car faster on the Earth or when I'm swinging the child faster on her swing is that the losses tend to increase.
Yeah, but you see, you're missing the point. You first start with the capacitor, then you said about the adore of the on the pot and two springs and very little energy to be delivered in between that. And then we have a conflicting situation in which the, you first compare that child on that tray to the swing, trying to prove the point. Now you're proving a point otherwise. Maybe we should say something about the car moving at 60 miles an hour and why at this speed we're losing a little of the least energy of gas and energy.
Okay, another comment, Dick.
The child on the tray at first was not a resonant system. At the end of each one of her deflections when she's sliding across the floor, my muscle power has to slow her down. My muscle power has to move her in the other direction, and I have to keep doing that at both ends, and I'm losing a whole lot of muscle power. Once I add the spring to that system, I convert it to a resonator. I still have to do a lot of force to get her moving the very first time. After that, very little cyclic force is required to keep her moving once I've established resonance. And now, once I add the springs to the child sitting on the cafeteria tray, it has a strong similarity to the child swinging on a real swing.
Okay, and we have a similarity to fluctuating flame. So probably the answer would be the less energy you use when you close it to the resonance.
Once I establish resonance, the rate of energy loss is now only a function of the volume of the deflection or the volume of the signal. In other words, if it's an LC network, if I want a bigger cyclic voltage, I have to put a slightly greater amount of energy in because there's always a certain amount of loss. So loss is proportional to temperature difference. Loss is proportional to magnitude of the swing. In the real world, in free space, where there is no loss, no matter what velocity I push that object at, it stays at that velocity. You've got to be very careful with your flame on the gas burner because there's a whole lot of acoustic dynamics taking place. Inside of that gas burner, there is an organ pipe. That organ pipe is a function of the way it's tuned, the way the gas is set, how high is the nozzle velocity, the temperature of the gases, the temperature of the fluids changes tremendously their density and therefore the resonant frequency. So there's a lot going on there. It's a very complicated system.
Beautiful. I think I have an answer to all of this controversy.
John wanted to make a comment. KC2WGB, go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, I just wanted to point out you're 100% right with the swing and all of that because I have a large 7-foot grandfather clock, which has a 5-foot pendulum, weighs about 8 pounds. And that little spring keeps that baby going for 8 days, and it's just a gentle nudge. So that mass is kept going for 8 days from that little minute spring in that clock. So it's exactly the same as the swing. That pendulum's a pendulum.
Okay, Wes, what are you going to say that's going to remove all the controversy.
Okay. I believe the secret to explain that phenomena is resonance. When I was observing that flame, the flame goes slower with fluctuation and then faster with the fluctuation, the less energy was used. Probably this is the genius of the German technology. That's why Canadian, if with cold temperature, use that. So, I might agree. I was wrong. I'm not very much convinced that the faster we go, the less energy we need to sustain. But I believe that if we put the body, no matter at which rate of swing, at the right resonance frequency, then we have the least energy use. Do you agree with that?
If the forcing function is synchronous with the resonant frequency, then yes, the magnitude of the forcing function goes to a minimum. That's very similar to what happens with an IF can. You've got a primary winding that's got a certain tune frequency, a secondary winding at a certain tune frequency, and the amount of energy you have to put into the primary winding in order to get the biggest signal out of the secondary winding, that amount of energy goes to a minimum when you're on the right resonant frequency of that system. That's how the IF can does its filtering. Because you've got a tube, back in the old tube radio days, you've got a tube that's driving that IF can, and when the signal comes down that tube at the exact frequency where that IF can resonates, minimum energy is required, you get maximum signal output. That's how it does its filtering. You could say that's how a filter works. And it requires a little bit of study to really convince yourself. Now, life gets a little bit complicated when the primary winding and the secondary winding are tuned to slightly different frequencies because you want to get a flat top response across a certain bandwidth in order to operate your FM-IF system. Life gets a little bit more complicated. Now we're getting into Chebyshev filtering characteristics. Anybody got any comments on all of the above? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, and when you have a time, I have a primary question that I wanted to ask today.
Maybe now is the time.
And to Xia. Light waves are about 5,000 angstroms in wavelength, while atoms are more like one angstrom across. Atoms are thousands of times smaller than light waves. Yet the atoms obviously interact very strongly with light. How can they do this? Perhaps they get around the problem of employing quantum mechanics, proton physics rather than electromagnetic waves. I'm not talking here about anything else but antennas. So, let me jump. When the metal dipole antenna is only 1 foot long, it certainly cannot absorb much of 5,000 foot wave radiation. And I would like to hear a good explanation for that phenomenon, if you will, and to exit.
One of my favorite subjects is the so-called E-field probe antenna. If I make an antenna that consists of a pretty large sheet of metal and a piece of wire sticking out of the middle of that sheet of metal with an insulator, and that piece of wire sticks up, oh, let me say, 2 inches. And now at the bottom of that piece of wire, where I normally would put a connector, I didn't put a connector. I put a real good field effect transistor. That real good field effect transistor might have an input impedance, which as a resistance is 10 to the 10 ohms. That's what? 100 megohms, or is it 10,000 megohms? It's a lot of ohms. The only real effect of the input transistor right at the base of that little piece of wire is that it's got a half a picofarad or a quarter of a picofarad of capacitance. That so-called E-field probe antenna does a beautiful job of sensing the E-field of the wave as it goes by. It does because it's almost a perfect open circuit. The input gate of that field effect transistor is the closest thing you and I can get to an open circuit. 10 to the 10 ohms and a small fraction of a picofarad. That antenna can have an extremely good response from a fraction of 1 megacycle up to 1,000 megacycles inclusive because it operates very different than any of the antennas we've ever used before. Any of the antennas you and I normally use, we set it up quite frequently as a 70-ohm dipole. The signal comes along. The dipole has a certain effective capture area, which we can calculate, gain lambda squared over 4 pi, numerically. It has a certain capture area. It captures some of the energy of that wave that's going through space,
couples that energy down the transmission line, and you can really measure how many picowatts and nanowatts, but it's real energy going into the receiver. In the case of that e-field probe antenna, it senses the number of volts per meter of the signal as it goes by. But because it presents an open circuit, it does not absorb energy. And let me give you a comparison to something we're more familiar with. Let me drop. When I first cut my teeth in electronics, way back in the 50s and 60s, the state-of-the-art of simple instrumentation we all owned was a volt-ohm milliammeter, a triplet or a Simpson. And each one of them had a, if they're well made, they had a 50 microampere meter movement. And once you study what's happening with a 50 microampere meter movement, you'll find out it always runs 20,000 ohms per volt. Set it on the 3-volt full scale, it is a 60,000 ohm resistor. Set it on the 100-volt scale, it is, a, let's see, 100 times 20,000, 100 times, yeah, would be, is that 2 megaohms? You can easily calculate it. The bottom line was is that that meter really sucked power out of the circuit you're measuring. A certain amount of current flow through that 20,000 ohms per volt circuit had to take place, and the power that the meter absorbed is what moved the needle. You supplied the power that moved the needle. And that became very important if you're trying to measure the automatic voltage gain control circuit of your tube-type receiver. That automatic gain control circuit of a tube-type receiver had an internal impedance of approximately 1 million ohms. You put your 20,000 ohm per volt meter on there because you expect 3 volts of AGC voltage, automatic gain control voltage, and you put your 20,000 ohm per volt meter there, you load down that circuit, you're listening to the volume coming out of the loudspeaker, you try to measure the AGC voltage with a VOM, you put the VOM on there, and all of a sudden you notice that the loudness of the speaker increases. You've loaded down the circuit, you've decreased the amount of voltage of the AGC because you've disturbed it. And then somebody comes along with a Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, which got a 10 megohm input impedance, and you measure the AGC voltage with the Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, and you notice that nothing, you measure a great big AGC voltage, you didn't load it down, and you don't see the change in the volume coming out of the loudspeaker. Because the gain circuit in the vacuum tube voltmeter took a very simple sample, a 10 megohm circuit, and the tubes provide the power that moved the meter. Our modern day digital voltmeters are like that. They've also got a 10 megohm input impedance. They don't load the circuit. The 9 volt battery in there and the amplifier is doing the work that moves the display. The meter is no longer a low impedance. So my point is that many of the antennas we've used in the past disturb the circuit, disturb the environment, because they have to suck power out of the environment. And if you're a radar man, that's very important. Because the normal antenna disturbs the environment, it creates a reflection. You can have an extremely stealthy, very carefully designed airplane that has a very low radar cross-section. It presents an extremely small target on the radar screen. But you want to put some electronics on board so that you can now communicate. And you slap some antennas on this beautiful airplane. Those antennas can easily give you a bigger echo than the whole damn airplane. Been there, done that. You've got to be very careful in the way you put antennas on a stealthy airplane. Because the antenna can give you more echo than the airplane. Because the antenna is disturbing the environment. Unless you're smart enough to use e-field probe antennas that don't disturb the environment, they don't create an echo. So there's a whole class of voltmeters, there's a whole class of antennas that use these two principles. They're very important principles. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, thank you for all of the explanation. I have a slightly different view on these antennas. An electrically small antenna is one of the physical antenna size, and it's far smaller than electromagnetic wave that is being received. And if we use them to transmit radio waves, they work just as you would expect. But in order to force a teeny antenna to send out a large amount of electromagnetic energy, we can simply give it a huge driving signal, high voltage on the teeny dipole or high current on the teeny loop antenna. If the electromagnetic field are strong at a distance of one wavelength from the small antenna, then the total electromagnetic radiation sent out by the antenna will be significant. And almost if the electromagnetic field themselves are acting as the antenna, weak fields act small, while intense fields behave as large antenna. This explains how the teeny antenna can transmit lots of electromagnetic waves, but the question is about the reception, not the transmitting. Back to you.
You're on to something here. I'm building an 80-meter dipole. I'm doing it in free space, far away from the ground, so I'm not worried about ground reflections. The 80-meter dipole is 132 feet long. Somebody 10 miles away is sending me a signal, and I measure a certain amount of signal on the full half-wave, 132-foot-long, 80-meter dipole antenna. And all of a sudden, I decide I want a miniature version. Instead of building it 132 feet long, I build it, let me pick a number, 20 feet long. Now let me build it 13 feet long. I've cut the dimensions down by, is that 10 to 1? Yes. I've cut the dimensions down by 10 to 1. I build 13.2-foot dipole instead of 132-foot dipole. I build it out of very good materials that have very low loss. I know that the antenna is going to have a huge capacitive reactance, which I'm going to resonate out. It's going to have a rather low resistance. I'm going to impedance match that. I've got an extremely good, very low loss impedance matching network. At this one center frequency that I care about, 3.6 megacycles, in both cases, I've resonated the antenna at exactly 3.6 megacycles. I got these two antennas side by side, just to be sure that they don't couple to each other. I've got them 200 feet apart. I first received the signal on the full 132-foot dipole. Then I received that exact same signal on this 13.2-foot dipole that I've carefully resonated. Yes, it's a very narrowband antenna, and I'm using it at exactly the same resonant frequency. How much smaller do you think the signal is on the small dipole compared to the big dipole? N2XJN, K2LAW.
In order for me to answer this question, I have to give you a little slightly different view on that subject. Based on what I think, it turns out that the similar idea works for the reception, for the input as opposed to the output. By manipulating electromagnetic fields, we can force an electrically small receiving antenna to behave as if it was very, very large. The secret is to intentionally impress the artificial AC field upon the receiving antenna, and will transmit in order to receive as it were. Conventional half-wave antennas already do exactly this because their electrons can slash back and forth, generating their electromagnetic fields. Let me drop. For example, the thin wires of the half-wave antenna are far too thin to block any incoming radio waves and absorb them. However, the current is such an antenna as well as the voltage between two wires. This sent out the large wide volume of, that would be the volume, right. Let me think about it, because I don't, okay. I got lost. Okay, I'm gonna repeat myself, hold on. We have a wide volume feeling electromagnetic fields which have a constant phase that is relative to incoming waves. And because of the of the constant phase, those fields interact very strongly with those incoming waves. They create a loss of the interference pattern, and this pattern has odd characteristics. Some of the incoming energy has vanished. The fields produced by the antenna have canceled out some of the energy of the impending electromagnetic waves. By my strong belief, we have to transmit in order to receive, and I am able to prove it.
Yes, by transmitting and receiving, you're reproducing the law of reciprocity. My question was, when I cut down the size of the dipole by 10 to 1 in physical length, but very carefully re-resonated it with a low-loss circuit, what's the difference in the signal strength that I receive between the full-size half-wave dipole and the one-tenth size half-wave dipole?
None.
The answer is half a dB. And the half a dB is not due to loss. It's due to a slight difference in the pattern.
You said carefully. When we do that very carefully in ideal situation, we don't lose half a dB.
You do lose half a dB because it's got a different pattern. The smaller dipole, when you plot the figure 8 pattern, the figure 8 is a little bit fatter. It isn't real loss. It's just that the main lobe is a little bit lower because the width of the main lobe got wider.
I agree.
97%.
What was that, John?
It'll be 97%.
Is that what half a dB is? I'll take your word for it.
I believe so.
Okay, so good common sense would say I've cut down the length of the dipole by 10 to 1. Therefore, the area probably went down by 100 to 1. If I asked every one of the guys I can find on 20 meters today that exact question when they finally understood it, they would say I'm going to get close to a 20 decibel loss, 100 to 1 change in area on the small dipole versus the large dipole. Good common sense. The magic of resonance. And by the way, the antenna is going to become very narrow band when I do that. It's going to be a very high Q structure, very narrow band. If I measured the rise time on pulses going through that antenna on transmit or pulses being received, I would find that it's got a much longer rise time and a much longer fall time. But for a steady state signal in that narrow band response curve of that antenna, that narrow antenna, it'll be within half a dB of the exact same gain. That's the so-called infinitesimal dipole, opposite of common sense. Where does all that extra area come from? A 80-meter dipole, full half-wave 80-meter dipole, really has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you saw that dipole in free space, you would see a great big black oval in space that's a little bit more than a half-wave from left to right and something like 3/8 of a wave from top to bottom, a great big black oval. And all of the energy entering that area gets sucked up by that black hole, that black oval, ends up on that wire, goes down that feed line, and moves the S-meter on that receiver. 8,500 square feet is the real effective area of an 80-meter dipole. You cut it down to a tenth of a length. You cut it down to a 13-foot dipole. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it's...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's still got almost the same area. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it's got something like 8,200 square feet. It's got 95% of the same area. And how in the world can it be sucking energy out of that great big chunk of space, even though this little bitty chunk of wire, one-tenth the length, is there doing it? That's the magic of resonance. When that energy on that frequency comes into the vicinity of that antenna, because of the very high Q resonance of that antenna, the energy couples over into that antenna.
Yeah, but I have a question. Could we have a more energy from the small antenna than we have from the large antenna? My understanding is, yes, we can.
KC2, can you hear the comment?
No, you can't.
So we take a loop antenna, for example. If we want our little loop antenna to receive far more energy than it normally would, then we need to produce large AC current in the antenna